Find all the case information you need faster. Smart litigators rely on Bloomberg Law's broad litigation news coverage and our market-leading dockets. Now with AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expansive state court coverage. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
In the future, it's likely more attorneys will describe themselves as neurodivergent, and we have the data to show why. On today's episode, we explain what that word really means and what law firms can be doing to be more accommodating. Hello, you're listening to On the Merits, the news podcast from Bloomberg Law and Bloomberg Government. I'm your host, David Schultz. So the phrase neurodivergence is one you may have heard get tossed around recently, and it's one you're going to hear a lot throughout this episode. At its core, the term is a sort of reframing of the way we talk about people with neurological or psychological disorders. Just like some people have brown eyes while others have blue eyes, people who are neurodivergent just have brains that work differently than the average person. Why does all this matter for the legal profession? Well, because according to a Bloomberg Law study conducted late last year, a quarter of law students self-identify as neurodivergent, compared with just 7% of practicing attorneys. That means legal workplaces are going to have to change in the coming years to accommodate these folks. And if they don't, well, we can see what might happen by looking at disability discrimination complaints. The data shows that at a time when overall disability complaints against employers are going down, complaints involving neurodiversity have shot up. The person who compiled all this data and crunched all these numbers is our guest today, Bloomberg Law analyst Jessica Blamire. She's going to help us break down what all this means, but first Jessica gets into the origins of the term neurodivergent.
Neurodiversity at its root is about recognizing that we all learn and communicate in different ways. The first person that really talked about neurodiversity was in the 1990s. It was a social scientist. So this isn't a medical term. This isn't something you'll find in the DSM for psychiatric disorders. It is a way that we can reframe how we're talking about how people's brains function and take it from talking about better or worse ways that brains work to just different ways, and that there is a range of different ways that the human brain can function.
Yeah. I mean, I'll have to admit, before I started working on this podcast and before I read your articles on this, you know, I thought that neurodivergence was kind of just another way of saying autism or something on the autism spectrum, that they were sort of synonymous. And that's not the case at all. In fact, you know, the data that you pulled up, which we'll get to in a minute, contains several different disorders that fall under the neurodivergent umbrella. And I just wanted to read a few of them just to give people a sense of how wide this is. So it's, as I just mentioned, autism falls under this, but also Alzheimer's, anxiety disorder, traumatic brain injury, depression, epilepsy, PTSD, schizophrenia. These are all be disorders that could fall under that umbrella.
Correct. And I should note that when it started, the person who developed it, the social scientist, she has autism spectrum disorder. So it did grow out of that, which is why I think we associate it with it. But now it has grown to have an umbrella of conditions that people recognize as neurodivergent, including, as you mentioned, anxiety, also ADHD, dyslexia. So it is much broader now. And when we actually asked survey respondents, when Bloomberg Law did the most recent law student preparedness survey, we didn't define it for them. So it was up to law students and practicing attorneys to determine what that meant.
Well, let's get into that. You know, and that's one of the two stories that you published here, which is, you know, law students identifying as neurodivergent compared to practicing lawyers. And there was a huge, huge difference.
Big difference.
Tell me about that. What did you find?
So we found for the last 2 years, which is when we started asking the question, about 7% of our practicing attorneys identified as neurodivergent, while a quarter of law students identified as neurodivergent.
So we're talking more than three times as many law students identify with this tag.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? What's going on here?
I think it's an increase in, not in neurodiversity, but an increase in understanding and acceptance of what it is, and that we're seeing that in the younger generations. Because frankly, I mean, this term developed in the 1990s. The language to discuss it wasn't there in the past. When I was in law school, which was 20 plus years ago, we weren't talking about things like this. And so law students today have the benefit of more information and knowledge and can understand more about how our brains work.
Yeah, and I want to get back to a point that you mentioned, which was, you know, getting away from saying certain brains function worse or better, just right. moving toward something where it's different. Because I think that it seems like what people who are identifying as neurodivergent are saying is that I can still do the job that anyone else can do. I, you know, am as capable as anyone else. It's just that my brain functions differently and I need certain accommodations as a result. Is that right?
Absolutely. And in some cases, people with neurodivergent brains might do certain tasks much better than someone with a quote-unquote, like, typical brain. So, yeah, they can do the same tasks. And if we really do want the best and the brightest in law, we need to recognize that people's brains work differently. And as you mentioned, might just need slightly different accommodations to bring that out.
Well, let's talk about that. What are some of those accommodations? What are some difficulties that neurodivergent people might run into in the workplace and specifically in the legal workplace at law firms?
So at law firms, I could see it affecting everything from the schedule to deadlines and assignments to learning the new skills to office spaces. Like if your law firm or company has an open office space as opposed to individual offices, and ways that firms and companies can work to offer some benefits that may not only allow people with neurodiverse brains to feel more included, but also will allow them to thrive. Things like a policy of written down deadlines or company-sponsored free headphones that cancel out noise, flexibility to work from home if that's something that does help the person stay on task. So there are things that can definitely benefit.
Well, let's talk about the other article that you wrote, which is about disability complaints involving neurodiversity. And I wanted to get into this because it seems like this is what happens when, you know, you have workplaces that don't necessarily provide the accommodations that are legally required.
Yeah, the complaints involving neurodiversity, and it encompasses all of the conditions that you mentioned earlier, have gone up 10% from 2016 to 2022, even though the number of ADA charges have gone down since 2016. We're seeing the percentage of those related to neurodiverse conditions go up by 10%.
We should say that those are against all employers, not just legal employers.
Absolutely. Yes, all employers.
But let's linger on that just for a moment here. So in a time when the total number of disability complaints against employers is going down, the number of disability complaints involving neurodiversity is going in the opposite direction. It's going up.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? What's going on there? I mean, is part of it just the visibility and the awareness?
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's an increase in the understanding. So people that do have neurodiverse brains understand more what can benefit them. I recently attended a series of discussions hosted by the DC Lawyer Assistance Program for people with ADHD, and that wasn't being discussed 20 years ago, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. And so as we understand more what can help us, then we see things getting asked for more.
I wonder, though, what law firms should be doing, because as we just discussed, you know, law students are much, much more likely, three times more likely than working attorneys to identify as neurodivergent. What should law firms be doing to prepare for this? And you already mentioned some of the things that they can do, you know, having policies that can accommodate people who are neurodivergent. But I wonder, though, also if law firms can do too much in that they treat these attorneys differently and kind of separate them from the rest of the pack. Is that also a risk there?
It's not a risk I've really considered. I think of it more as a DEI issue at the heart and to make people feel included. And I don't know if there can be a thing as too much inclusion. But I think the difference, though, is you don't want to go so far that you're treating it as an automatic disability as opposed to just a different way that your brain works. And in not all cases will someone actually qualify or want to qualify for ADA accommodations, for example. It may not qualify as a disability, but it does qualify as a difference in how we learn and how we communicate. And it's something that I really think law firms just need to be aware of as they're making their employees feel included and as they're recruiting for their next class of lawyers. Bloomberg Law recently did its DEI framework for 2023, and we asked the law firms that were participating what they're doing in relation to neurodiversity, and we're seeing some law firms do it. The percentages aren't very high, but we're seeing 14% consider it when it comes to recruiting. We're seeing, you know, 15% consider neurodiversity as an identification when it comes to promoting those to leadership. And a much smaller percentage, like 6%, have employee resource groups focused on those with neurodiversity, support in-house support groups, basically.
And then finally, you know, getting back to those EEOC complaint numbers, do you see those numbers going up in the future? I guess, you know, I'm asking you to predict the future, so you never know. But it seems like, you know, that could be a rising trend that could be with us for a long time in the future. Where do you see this going?
I see it at least staying where it is or increasing, particularly because of the push back into the office by so many companies that might necessitate accommodations as people go back into the office and their environments change from what they've been used to the last number of years.
Yeah, I do wonder if that the reason why the overall number of disability complaints has been going down is because of that, because of the more flexible work arrangements during the pandemic, and that, you know, that is ending.
Right. And the only year that the data show that the neurodivergence complaints didn't go up, they just stayed the same, was around that 2021 timeframe. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was Jessica Blaymeyer talking with us about neurodivergence and law firms. Thank you, Jessica, so much for talking. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for today's episode of On the Merits. It was produced by myself, David Schultz. Our editor was Andrew Satter. And our executive producer is Josh Block. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Smart litigators find winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And that's not all. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.